Chapter 3. On this, the last day, the tyrant told the truth. His child, who had walked from the dark world, now rose as a banner before his father's walls, and flames mocked like celebrants from every window, 1,000,000 handfuls of ash upon the scene. It is said that blood holds neither memory nor loyalty. On this, the last day, the tyrant thus beheld a truth. The son was born in a dark room to womanly cries, and walked a dark keep along halls echoing pain, only to flee on a moonless night beneath the cowl of his master's weighted fist and ravaging face. The beget proved to all that a shadow stretches far, only to march back to its dire maker, ever deepening. Its matching desire, and this truth is plain as it is blind, tyrants and saints alike must fall to the ground, in their last breaths taken in turn by the shadow of their final repose, where truth holds them fast on a bed of stone. The sun walks far. Restlo Faran.
Your kisses make my lips numb.
It's the cloves,
Shorkelal replied, sitting up on the edge of the bed.
Got a toothache?
Not that I'm aware of.
Scanning the clothing littering the floor, she spied her leggings and reached over to collect them.
You marching soon?
We are, I suppose so. The adjunct's not one to let us know her plans.
Commander's privilege.
She rose to tug the leggings up, frowning as she wriggled. Was she getting fat? Was that even possible?
Now there's a sweet dance. I'm of a mind to just lean forward here and...
I wouldn't do that, love.
Why not?
You'll get yourself a numb face. A woman needs her secrets. Well, this one does at least.
I'm also of a mind to stay right here, the Malazan said.
Leaning far over to lace up her boots, Shurk scowled.
It's not even midnight, Captain. I wasn't planning on a quiet evening at home.
You're insatiable. Why, if I was half the man I'd like to be...
She smiled. It was hard being annoyed with this one. She'd even grown used to that broad waxed moustache beneath his misshapen nose. But he was right about her in ways even he couldn't imagine. Insatiable indeed. She tugged on the deerhide jerkin and tightened the straps beneath her breasts.
Careful. You don't want to constrict your breathing, Shurk. Hood knows, the fashions hereabouts all seem designed to emasculate women. Would that be the right word? Emasculate? Everything seems designed to imprison you. Your spirit, as if a woman's freedom was some kind of threat.
All self-imposed, sweetie, she replied, clasping her weapon belt and then collecting her cape from where it lay in a heap on the floor.
She shook it out.
Take 10 women, all best friends. Watch one get married. Before you know it, she's top of the pile, sitting smug and superior on her marital throne. And before long, every woman in that gaggle's on the hunt for a husband.
She swung the cape behind her and fastened the clasps at her shoulders.
And Queen Perfect Bitch sits up there nodding her approval.
History? My, my. Anyway, that doesn't last.
Oh?
Sure. It's sweet blossoms until her husband runs off with one of those best friends.
She snorted and then cursed.
Damn you, I told you not to make me laugh.
Nothing will crack the perfection of your face, Shorkelal.
You know what they say, age stalks us all, Ruthangard.
Some old hag hunting you down? No sign of that.
She made her way to the door.
You're lovely, Ruthan, even when you're full of crap. My point was, most women don't like each other. Not really. Not in the general sense. If one ends up wearing chains, she'll paint them gold and exhaust herself scheming to see chains on every other woman. It's our innate nasty streak. Lock up when you leave.
As I said, I intend staying the night.
Something in his tone made her turn round. Her immediate reaction was to simply kick him out, if only to emphasize the fact that he was a guest, not an errant damned member of the household. But she'd heard a whisper of iron beneath the man's words.
Problems in the Malazan compound, Captain?
There's an adept in the Marines.
Adept at what? Should you introduce him to me? His gaze flicked away, and he slowly edged up in the bed to rest his back against the headboard.
Our version of a caster of the tiles. Anyway, the adjunct has ordered a casting. Tonight, starting about now.
And?
The man shrugged. Maybe I'm just superstitious, but the idea has given me a state of the nerves.
No wonder you were so energetic. And you want to stay as far away as possible?
Aye.
All right, Ruthen. I should be back before dawn, I hope. We can breakfast together.
Thanks, Shurk. Oh, have fun and don't wear yourself out.
Little chance of that, love. Get your rest, she said, opening the door. Come the morning, you'll need it.
Always give them something before leaving. Something to feed anticipation, since anticipation so well served to blind a man to certain obvious discrepancies in, appetite. She descended the stairs.
Cloves. Ridiculous.
Another visit to Selosh was required. Shurk Elal's present level of maintenance was proving increasingly complicated, not to mention egregiously expensive. Stepping outside, she was startled as a huge figure loomed out from the shadows of an alcove.
Ublala! Shades of the empty throne, you startled me! What are you doing here?
Who is he?
The giant demanded.
I'll kill him for you if you like.
No, I don't like. Have you been following me around again? Listen, I've explained all this before, haven't I?
Ublala Pung's gaze dropped to his feet. He mumbled something inaudible.
What?
Yes. I said yes, Captain. Oh, I want to run away.
I thought Tehel had you inducted into the palace guard, she said, hoping to distract him.
I don't like polishing boots.
Ublala, you only have to do that once every few days, or you can hire someone.
Not my boots, everyone else's.
The other guards?
He nodded glumly.
Ublala, walk with me. I will buy you a drink, or three.
They set off up the street towards the canal bridge.
Listen, those guards are just taking advantage of your kindness. You don't have to polish their boots.
I don't?
No, you're a guardsman. If Tehol knew about it, well, you should probably tell your comrades in the guard that you're going to have a word with your best friend, the king.
He is my best friend, isn't he? He gave me chicken.
They crossed the bridge, waving at swarming sludge flies, and made their way onto an avenue flanking one of the night markets. More than the usual number of Malazan soldiers wandering about, she noted.
Exactly. Chicken. And a man like Tehol won't share chicken with just anyone, will he?
I don't know. Maybe.
No, no, Ublala. Trust me on this. You've got friends in high places. The king, the chancellor, the cedar, the queen, the king's sword. Any one of them would be delighted to share chicken with you, and you can bet they wouldn't be so generous with any of your fellow guards.
So I don't have to polish boots?
Just your own, or you can hire someone to do that.
What about stitching tears in their uniforms? Sharpening their knives and swords? And what about washing their underclothes?
Stop! None of that! And now especially I want you to promise to talk to your friends. Any one of them. Tehol, Bug, Bryce, Janath. Will you do that for me? Will you tell them what the other guards are making you do?
All right.
Good. Those bastard comrades of yours in the guard are in for some serious trouble. Now, here's a suitable bar. They use benches instead of chairs, so you won't be getting stuck like last time.
Good. I'm thirsty. You're a good friend, Shurk. I want to sex you.
How sweet. But just so you understand, lots of men sex me, and you can't let that bother you, all right?
All right.
Ublala.
Yes, all right. I promise.
Kisware sat slumped in the saddle as the troop rode at a slow trot towards the city of Letharas. She would not glance across to her sister, Cinta, lest the guilt she was feeling simply overwhelm her, a clawing, stabbing clutch at her soul, dragging it into oblivion. She'd known all along Cinta would follow her anywhere. and when the recruiter train rolled into their village in the jungles of Dalhan. Well, it had been just one more test of that secret conviction. The worst of it was, joining the Marines had been little more than a damned whim, spurred by a bit of a local mess, the spiralling inward of suspicions that would find at its heart none other than Kiswere herself, the cursed other woman who dwelt like a smiling shadow unseen on the edge of a family. Oh, she would have weathered the scandal, with just one more toss of her head and a few careless gestures. It wasn't that she loved the man. All the forest spirits well knew that an adulterous man wasn't worth a woman's love, for he lived only for himself and would make no sacrifice in the name of his wife's honour, nor that of their children. No, her motives had been rather less romantic. Boredom proved a cruel shepherd. The switch never stopped snapping. A hunger for the forbidden added yet another dark shade to the cast of her impulses. She'd known all along that there would come a time when they'd drive her from the village, when she'd be outcast for the rest of her life. Such banishment was no longer a death sentence. The vast world beyond the jungle now opened a multitude of escape routes. The Malazan Empire was vast, holding millions of citizens on three continents. Yes, she knew she would have no difficulty vanishing within that blessed anonymity. And besides, she knew she'd always have company. Cinta, so capable, so practical, was the perfect companion for all her adventures. And oh, the White Jackal well knew, her sister was a beauty, and together they'd never have to fear an absence of male company. The recruiters seemed to offer a quick escape, fortuitous in its timing, and were happy to pay all travel expenses, so she'd grasped hold of the hyena's tail. And sure enough, Sister Cinta was quick to follow. It should have ended there, but Badan Gruk was whipped into the rushing current of their wake. The fool had fallen for Cinta. If she'd bothered putting any thought behind her decisions, she would have comprehended the terrible disaster she had dragged them all into. The Malazan Marines demanded a service of 10 years, and Kiswere had simply smiled and shrugged and then had signed on for the long count, telling herself that as soon as she tired of the game, she'd just desert the ranks and once more vanish into anonymity. Alas, Cinta's nature was a far tighter weave. What she took inside, she kept, and a vow once made was held to, right down to her dying breath. It did not take long for Kiswere to realize the mistake she'd made. She couldn't very well run off and abandon her sister, who'd then gone and showed enough of her talents to be made a sergeant. And although Kiswere was more or less indifferent to Badan Gruk's fate, the man so wretchedly ill-cast as a soldier, still more so as a squad sergeant, it had become clear to her that Cinta had tightened some knots between them. Just as Cinta had followed Kiswere, so Badan Gruk had followed Cinta. But the grisly yoke of responsibility proved not at the core of the ties between Cinta and Badan Gruk. There was something else going on. Did her sister in fact love the fool? Maybe. Life had been so much easier back in the village, despite all the sneaking round and frantic hip-locking in the bushes up from the river. At least then Kiswere was on her own, and no matter what happened to her, her sister would have been free of it, and safe. Could she take it all back? This jaunt among the Marines was likely to kill them all. It had stopped being fun long ago. The horrid voyage on those foul transports, all the way to Seven Cities, the march, Yigatan, more sea voyages, Malaz City, the coastal invasion on this continent, the night on the river, chains, darkness, rotting cells, and no food. No, Kiswere could not look across at Cinta and so witness her broken state. Nor could she meet Badan Gruk's tortured eyes, all that raw grief and anguish. She wished she had died in that cell. She wished they had taken the adjunct's offer of discharge once the outlawing was official, but Cinta would have none of that. Of course not. They were riding in darkness, but Kiswere sensed when her sister suddenly pulled up. Soldiers immediately behind them veered aside to avoid the horses colliding. Grunts, curses, and then Badan Gruk's worried voice.
Cinta, what's wrong?
Cinta twisted in her saddle.
Is Nep with us? Nep Furrow?
No,
Badan replied. Kiswere saw real fear sizzle awake in her sister, and her own heart started pounding in answer. Cinta had sensitivities.
In the city, We need to hurry.
Wait, croaked Kiswa. Center, please. If there's trouble there, let them handle it.
No, we have to ride.
And suddenly she drove heels into her horse's flanks and the beast lunged forward. A moment later, and everyone was following, Kiswa in their company. Her head spun. She thought she might well be flung from her mount, too weak, too weary. But her sister, Cinta, her damned sister, she was a marine now. She was one of the adjunct's very own. And though that bitch had no idea, it was soldiers like Cinta, the quiet ones, the insanely loyal ones, who were the iron spine of the bone hunters. Malice flashed through Kiswer, ragged as a flag at midnight.
Badan knows it. I know it. Tavare, you've stolen my sister, and that, you cold bitch, I will not accept. I want her back, damn you. I want my sister back.
So where is the fool?
Fist Keneb shrugged. Arbin prefers the company of heavies, the soldiers with dirt on their noses and dust storms in their skulls. The Fist plays knuckles with them, gets drunk with them. Probably sleeps with some of them, for that matter. Blistig grunted as he sat down.
And this is the proper way to earn respect?
That depends, I suppose, Keneb said. If Arbin wins at knuckles, drinks everyone else under the table, and wears out every lover brave enough to share a bed, then maybe it works.
Don't be a fool, Keneb. A Fist needs to keep distant, bigger than life and meaner besides.
He poured himself another tankard of the foamy local beer.
Glad you're sitting here, I'd imagine.
I didn't even belong at the last reading. I was there in Grubb's place, that's all.
Now the boy's got to swallow his own troubles.
Blistig leaned forward. They had found an upscale tavern, overpriced and so not likely to draw any Malazan soldiers below the rank of captain. And for a time over the past weeks, the Fists had gathered here, mostly to drink and complain.
What's one of those readings like? You hear all sorts of rumours. People spitting up newts or snakes slithering out of their ears, and woe betide any baby born at that moment anywhere in the district. Three eyes and forked tongues.
He shook his head, drank down three quick mouthfuls, and then wiped at his mouth.
It's said that whatever happened at that last one, it made up the adjunct's mind about everything that followed. The whole night in Malaz City, all skirling out with the cards, even Kalam's murder.
We don't know he was murdered, cut in Keneb.
You were there in that cabin,
Blistig insisted.
What happened?
Keneb glanced away, suddenly wanting something stronger than beer. He found that he was unaccountably chilled, clammy as if fevered. It's about to begin, he muttered. Touched once.
Anybody with neck hairs has left the barracks, did you know that? The whole damned army has scattered into the city tonight. You're scaring me, Keneb.
Relax, he heard himself reply. I spat up only one newt, as I recall. Here comes Madan. Deadsmell had hired a room for the night, fourth floor with a balcony and quick access to the roof, a damned month's wages, but he had a view of the temporary headquarters. Well, its squat dome, at any rate, and at the far end of the inn's roof, it was a short drop to an adjoining building, a quick sprint across its length and down to an alley not three streets from the river. Best he could do, all things considered. Masangilani had arrived with a cask of ale and a loaf of bread, though the only function Deadsmell could foresee for the bread was to be used to soak up vomit. Gods knew he wasn't hungry. Ebron, Shard, Cord, Limp and Crump then crowded in, arms loaded with dusty bottles of wine. The mage was deathly pale and shaky. Cord, Shard and Limp looked frightened, while Crump was grinning like a man struck senseless by a fallen tree branch. Scowling at them all, Deadsmell lifted his own knapsack from the floor and set it with a thump on the lone table. At the sound, Ebron's head snapped round.
Hood take you, necromancer, you and your stinking magics. If I'd have known...
You weren't even invited, Deadsmell said in a growl. And you can leave any time. And what's that ex-irregular doing with that driftwood?
I'm going to carve something,
Crump said with a bright toothy smile, like a horse begging an apple.
Maybe a big fish, or a troop of horse soldiers, or a giant salamander. Oh, that could be dangerous. Oh, too dangerous. Unless and I give its tail a plug so you can pull it off, and a hinged jaw that goes up and down and makes laughing sounds. Why, I could...
Stuff it in your mouth is what you could do, Dead Smell cut in. Better yet, I'll do it for you, sapper.
The smile faltered.
No need to be mean and all. We all come here to do stuff. Sergeant Cord and Corporal Shard are gonna drink, they said, and pray to the Queen of Dreams. Limp's gonna sleep and Ebron's gonna make protection magics and all.
His equine eyes swiveled to Masangilani, who was slumped in the lone cushy chair, legs outstretched, lids lowered, fingers laced together on her lap, and Crump's long jaw slowly sagged.
And she's gonna be beautiful, he whispered.
Sighing, Dead Smell untied the pack's leather strings and began lifting out various small dead creatures. A flicker bird, a black-furred rat, an iguana, and a strange blue-skinned, big-eyed thing that might be a bat or a shell-less turtle. He'd found the fox-sized creature hanging by its three-tipped tail on a stall in the market. The old woman had cackled when he'd purchased it, a rather ominous reaction as far as Dead Smell was concerned. Even so, he had a decent enough. Glancing up, he saw that everyone was staring at him.
What?
Crump's frown was darkening his normally insipid face into something alarming.
You, he said, you're not, by any chance, you're not a necromancer, are you?
I didn't invite you here, Crump.
Ebron was sweating.
Listen, sapper, you, Crump Bowl, or whatever your name is, you're not a motte regular no longer, remember that. You're a soldier, a bone hunter. You take orders from Cord, Sergeant Cord, right?
Clearing his throat, Cord spoke up.
That's right, Crump. And, I'm ordering you to carve.
Crump blinked, licked his lips, and then nodded at his sergeant.
Carve, right. What do you want me to carve, Sergeant? Go on, anything. Except not no necromancers, all right?
Sure. How about everybody here in this room? Except Dead Smell, of course, but everyone else. Riding horses, galloping horses, horses galloping over flames.
Crump wiped at his lips and shot Masangilani a shy glance.
Her too, Sergeant. Go ahead, Masangilani drawled. Can't wait to see it. Don't forget to include yourself, Crump, on the biggest horse.
Yeah, with a giant sword in one hand and a cusser in the other.
Perfect.
Dead Smell returned to his menagerie of dead animals, arranging them in a circle, head to tail, on the tabletop.
Gods, those stink, Limp said. Can't you dip them in scented oils or something?
No, I can't. Now shut up, everyone. This is about saving all our skins, right? Even yours, Ebron, as if Rashan's going to help one whit tonight. To keep Hood from this room is down to me. So, no more interruptions unless you want to kill me.
Crump's head bobbed up.
That sounds perfect.
And everyone else, too, including you, Crump.
That doesn't sound so perfect.
Carve,
Cord ordered. The sapper bent his head back down to the task once more, the tip of his tongue poking out like a botfly grub coming up for air. Dead Smell fixed his attention on the array of carcasses. The fox-sized bat turtle thing seemed to be staring up at him with one giant doe eye. He fought down a shiver, the motion becoming a flinch when the dead iguana languidly blinked.
"Gods below," he moaned. "High House Death has arrived."
Corks started popping.
"We're being followed."
"What? Now, that's your shadow, is all. We're the ones doing the following, right? I ain't lowing no two-faced corporal of mine to go AWOL. Now, we turn left here."
"Right, Hellion. You just turned right."
"That's only 'cause we're side by side, meaning you see it different.
It was left for me, and if it's right for you, that's your problem. Now look, is that a brothel? He went up a brothel? What kind of corporal of mine is he? What's wrong with Melazan women, eh? We get him, and I want you to cut off his balls, okay? Put an end to this once and for all.
When they arrived at the narrow stairs, tucked between two broad, antiquated entrances, Hellion reached out with both hands, as if to grasp the rails. But there were no rails, and so she fell flat onto the steps, audibly cracking her chin.
Ow! Damn rails broke right off in my hands!
And she groped and clutched with her fingers.
Turned to dust, too, see?
Herb leaned closer to make sure her sodden brains weren't leaking out, not that Hellion would notice, and was relieved to see nothing more than a minor scrape on the underside of her chin. While she struggled to her feet, patting at her bleached hair, he glanced back once more up the street they had just come down.
It's Skull Death doing the lurking, Hellion.
She reeled round, blinking owlishly.
Squeal Death? Him again?
She made more ineffectual adjustments to her hair.
Oh, he's a darling thing, isn't he? Wants to climb into my knickers.
Hellion, Herb groaned. He's made that desire plain enough. He wants to marry you.
She glared.
No, no, Egypt. He wants to wear 'em. All the rest he don't know nothing about. He's only done it with boys, you see. Kept trying to get on his stomach under me, or me doing the same under him, with the wrong hole showing, and we end up wrestling instead of other more fun stuff. Anyway, let's go and get our corporal before he descends into corruption.
Frowning to hide his discomfiture, Herb followed Hellion swaying behind up the stairs.
Soldiers use whores all the time, Hellion.
It's their innocence, Herb, that a right and proper sergeant needs to concern herself with.
They're grown men, Hellion. They ain't so innocent.
Who? I was talking about my corporal, about Touchy Breathless. The way he's always talking with himself, no woman's going to go near him. Being insane ain't a quality women look for, you know. In their men, I mean.
She waved vaguely at the door in front of her.
Which is why they's now trying whores, and I ain't going to allow it.
She tried a few times to grasp the latch, finally succeeded, and then twisted it in both directions, up and down, up and down.
Gaw blow! Who invented this piece of crud?
Herb reached past her and pushed open the door. Hellion stepped in, still trying to work the latch.
Don't worry, Herb. I'll get it right. Just watch and learn.
He edged past her and paused in the narrow hallway, impressed by the extraordinary wallpaper, which seemed to consist of gold leaf, poppy red velvet, and swaths of piebald rabbit skins, all in a crazed pattern that unaccountably made him want to empty his coin purse. And the black wooden floor, polished and waxed until it seemed almost liquid, as if they were walking upon glass beneath which waited the torment of unending oblivion. He wondered if the whole thing weren't ensorcelled.
Where are you going?
Hellion demanded.
You opened the door, Herb said, and asked me to take point.
I did? I did? Take point? In a brothel?
That's right.
Okay, then get your weapon out, Herb, in case we get jumped.
He hesitated and then said,
I'm a fast draw, Hellion.
Not what I've seen,
she said behind him. Confused, he paused again.
What do you mean?
Meaning you need some lessons in corruption, I'd say.
She straightened up, but that wasn't so straight, since she used a wall to manage the posture.
Unless, of course, it's squat death you want. Not that you'd fit in my knickers, though. Hey, are these baby pelts?
Rabbit. I ain't interested in skull death, Hellion. And no, I don't want to wear your knickers. Listen, you two!
Someone snapped from behind a door to one side.
Quit that foreign jabbering and find a room!
Face darkening, Hellion reached for her sword, but the scabbard was empty.
Who stole? You, Herb. Give me your sword, damn you, or bust down this door. Yeah, this one here. Bust it down the middle. Use your head. Smash it!
Instead of attempting any of that, Herb took Hellion's arm and guided her farther down the corridor.
"They're not in that one," he said. "That man was speaking Lethary."
"That was Lethary? That foreign jabber? No wonder this city's full of Egypts talking like that."
Herb moved up alongside another door and leaned close to listen. He grunted. "Voices, negotiating. This could be the one."
"Kick it down, bash it. Find us a battering ram or a cusser or an angry napan."
Herb flipped the latch and shoved the door back, and then he stepped inside. Two corporals, mostly undressed, and two women, one stick-thin, the other grossly fat, all staring at him with wide eyes. Herb pointed at Breathless and then at Touchy.
"You two, get your clothes on. Your sergeant's in the corridor."
"No, I ain't."
And Hellion reeled into the room, eyes blazing.
"He hired two of them. Corruption. Scat, hags, afore I cut my leg off."
The thin one spat something and suddenly had a knife in her hand, waving it threateningly as she advanced on Hellion. The fat prostitute picked up a chair and lumbered forward a step behind her. Herb chopped one hand down to crack on the knife wielder's wrist, sending the weapon clattering on the floor, and used his other to grasp the fat woman's face and push her back. Squealing, the monstrous whore fell onto her ample backside. The room shook with the impact. Clutching her bruised forearm, the skinny one darted past and out the door, shrieking. The corporals were scrambling with their clothes, faces frantic with worry.
"Get a refund!" Hellion bellowed. "Those two should be paying you, not t'other way round. Hey, who called in the army?"
The army, as it turned out, was the establishment's six pleasure guards, armed with clubs. But the fight in the room only turned nasty when the fat woman waded back in, chair swinging. Standing near the long table, Bryce Bedict took a cautious sip of the foreign ale, bemused at the motley appearance of the reading's participants, the last of whom arrived half drunk with a skittish look to his eyes, an ex-priest of some sort, he surmised. They were a serious, peculiar lot, these Malazans, with a talent for combining offhand casual rapport with the grimmest of subject matter, a careless repose and loose discipline with savage professionalism. He was, he admitted, oddly charmed. At the same time, the adjunct was somewhat more challenging in that respect. Tavare Paran seemed virtually devoid of social graces, despite her noble ancestry, which should have schooled her in basic decorum, as indeed her high military rank should have smoothed all the jagged edges of her nature. The adjunct was awkward in command and clumsy in courtesy, as if consistently distracted by some insurmountable obstacle. Bryce could imagine that such an obstacle might well be found in the unruliness of her legions, and yet her officers and soldiers displayed not a flicker of insubordination, not a single eye roll behind her back, nor the glare of daggers cast sidelong. There was loyalty, yes, but it was strangely flavoured, and Bryce was still unable to determine its nature. Whatever the source of the adjunct's distraction, she was clearly finding no release from its strictures, and Bryce thought that the burden was slowly overwhelming her. Most of the others were strangers to him, or at best vaguely familiar faces attesting to some past incidental encounter. He knew the high mage, Ben Adifon Delat, known to the other Malazans as Quick Ben, although to Bryce that name seemed a version lacking in the respect a cedar surely deserved. He knew Hedge and Fiddler as well, both of whom had been among the soldiers first into the palace. Others in the group startled him. Two children, a boy and a girl, and a Tistandi woman, mature in years and manner and clearly put out by her inclusion in this ragged assembly. All the rest, with the exception of the ex-priest, were officers or soldiers in the adjunct's army. Two gold-skinned, fair-haired marines, neither young, named Gessler and Stormy. A nondescript man named Bottle, who couldn't be much older than two decades, and Tavare's aide, the startlingly beautiful tattooed officer Lostara Yil, who moved with a dancer's grace and whose exotic features were only tempered by an air of ineffable sorrow. Soldiers lived difficult lives, Bryce well knew, friends lost in horrible sudden ways, scars hardening over the years, ambitions crushed and dreams set aside. The world of possibilities diminished and betrayals threatened from every shadow. A soldier must place his or her trust in the one who commands, and by extension, in that which the commander serves in turn. In the case of these bone hunters, Bryce understood that they and their adjunct had been betrayed by their empire's ruler. They were adrift, and it was all Tavare could do to hold the army together. That they had launched an invasion of Lether was in itself extraordinary. Divisions and brigades in his own kingdom's history had mutinied in response to commands nowhere near as extreme. For this reason alone, Bryce held the adjunct in true respect, and he was convinced that she possessed some hidden quality, a secret virtue that her soldiers well recognized and responded to. And Bryce wondered if he would come to see it for himself, perhaps this very night. Although he stood at ease, curious and moderately attentive, sipping his ale, he could well sense the burgeoning tension in the room. No one was happy, least of all the sergeant who would awaken the guards. The poor man looked as bedraggled as a dog that had just swum the breadth of River Lether, his eyes red-shot and bleak, his face battered as if he had been in a brawl. The young soldier named Bottle was hovering close to Fiddler, and employing, perhaps for Bryce's benefit, the trader tongue, he spoke to the sergeant in a low tone.
"Time for a rusty gauntlet?"
"What? A what?"
"That drink you invented last reading."
"No, no alcohol. Not this time. Leave me alone until I'm ready."
"How will we know when you're ready?" Lostari Yil asked him.
"Just sit down in any order, Captain. You'll know." He shot the adjunct a beseeching look. "There's too much power here. Way too much. I've no idea what I'll bring down. This is a mistake."
Tavare's pinched features somehow managed to tauten.
"Sometimes, Sergeant, mistakes are necessary."
Hedge coughed abruptly and then waved a hand.
"Sorry, adjunct, but you're talking to a sapper there. Mistakes mean we turn into red mist. I take it you're referring to other kinds, maybe. I hope."
The adjunct swung to Gessler's oversized companion.
"Adjutant Stormy, how does one turn an ambush?"
"I ain't no adjutant anymore," the bearded man growled.
"Answer my question."
The huge man glared then, seeing as it elicited no reaction whatsoever from the adjunct. He grunted and then said,
"You spring it and then charge 'em, hard and fast. You climb down the bastard's throats."
"But first the ambush must be sprung."
"Unless you can sniff 'em out beforehand, aye."
His small eyes fixed on her.
"We gonna sniff or charge tonight, adjunct?"
Tavare made no reply to that, facing the Tistandi woman instead.
"Sendeleth Drukolat, please sit. I understand your reluctance." "I don't know why I'm here," Sandalath snapped.
"History," muttered the ex-priest.
A long moment of silence, and then the girl named Sin giggled, and everyone jumped. Seeing this, Bryce frowned.
"Excuse me for interrupting, but is this the place for children?"
Quick Ben snorted.
"The girl's a high mage, Bryce, and the boy's, well, he's different."
"Different?"
"Touched," said Banaskar. "And not in a good way, either. Please, adjunct, call it off. Send Fiddler back to the barracks. There's too many here. The safest readings involve a few people, not a mob like this one. Your poor reader's gonna start bleeding from the ears halfway through."
"He's right," said Quick Ben, shifting uneasily in his chair. "Fid's ugly enough without earrings of blood and whatnot."
The adjunct faced Fiddler.
"Sergeant, you know my desire in this. More than anyone else here, you also know my reasons. Speak now honestly. Are you capable of this?"
All eyes fixed on the sapper, and Bryce could see how everyone, excepting perhaps Sin, was silently imploring Fiddler to snap shut the lid on this dread box. Instead, he grimaced, staring at the floor, and said,
"I can do it, adjunct. That's not the problem. It's unexpected guests."
Bryce saw the ex-priest flinch at that, and a sudden hot flood of alarm rose through the king's sword. He stepped forward. But the deck was in Fiddler's hands, and he was standing at one end of the table, even though not everyone had taken seats, and three cards clattered and slid on the polished surface. The reading had begun.
Standing in the gloom outside the building, the errant staggered back as if buffeted by invisible fists. He tasted blood in his mouth and hissed in fury. In the main room of her small home, Seren Pedak's eyes widened, and then she shouted in alarm as Pinnacell and Ersto Hubart ignited into flames where they sat, and she would have lunged forward if not for Bug's staying hand, a hand sheathed in sweat.
"Do not move," the old man gasped. "Those fires burn nothing but them."
"Nothing but them? What does that mean?"
It was clear that the two ancient gods had ceased being aware of their surroundings. She could see their eyes staring out through the blue flames, fixed upon nothing.
"Their essence," Bug whispered. "They are being devoured by the power awakened."
He was trembling as if close to incapacitation, sweat streaming like oil down his face. Seren Pedak edged back and placed her hands upon her swollen belly. Her mouth was dry, her heart pounding hard.
"Who assails them?"
"They stand between your child and that power, as do I, Aquitor. We can withstand. We must."
"Who is doing this?"
"Not malign, just vast. Abyss below, this is no ordinary caster of the tiles."
She sat, terrified now, her fear for her unborn son white hot in her soul, and stared at Pinnacell and Ersto Hubart, who burned and burned, and beneath the flames they were melting like wax. In a crowded room on the top floor of an inn, a flurry of once-dead beasts now scampered, snarled, and snapped jaws. The black-furred rat, trailing entrails, had suddenly fallen upward to land on the ceiling, claws digging into the plaster, intestines dangling like tiny sausages in a smokehouse. The blue bat turtle had bitten off the iguana's tail, and that creature escaped in a slithering dash and was now butting at the window's shutters as if desperate to get out. The flicker bird, shedding oily feathers, flapped in frantic circles over the heads of everyone, none of whom had time to notice as bottles smashed down, wine spilling like thinned blood, and the barely begun carving of riders on charging horses now writhed and reared on Crump's lap, whilst he stared bug-eyed, mouth gaping, and moments later the first tiny horse dragged itself free and leapt down from the sapper's thigh, wooden hoofs clopping across the floor, misshapen lump of rider waving a splinter. Bellowing, shouts, shrieks, Ebron vomited violently, and ducking to avoid that gush, Limp slipped in a puddle of wine and shattered his left knee. He howled. Dead Smell started crawling for a corner. He saw Masan Gilani roll under the fancy bed as the flicker bird cracked headlong into a bedpost, exploding in a cloud of rank feathers.
"Smart woman. Now if only there was room under there for me, too."
In another section of the city, witnesses would swear in the errant's name, swear indeed on the empty throne and on the graves of loved ones, that two dragons burst from the heart of an inn, wreckage sailing out in a deadly rain of bricks, splinters, dust and fragments of sundered bodies that cascaded down into streets as far as 50 paces away. And even in the aftermath the next morning, no other possible explanation sufficed to justify that shattered ruin of an entire building, from which no survivors were pulled. The entire room trembled, and even as Helion drove her elbow into a bearded face and heard a satisfying crunch, the wall opposite her cracked like fine glass and then toppled into the room, burying the figures thrashing about in pointless clinches on the floor. Women screamed. Well, the fat one did, and she was loud enough and repetitive enough in those shrieks to fill in for everyone else, all of whom were too busy scrabbling out from the wreckage. Helion staggered back a step, and then, as the floor suddenly heaved, she found herself running, although she could not be sure of her precise direction, but it seemed wise to find the door wherever that might be. When she found it, she frowned, since it was lying flat on the floor, and so she paused and stared down for a time, until Herb stumbled into her.
"Something just went up across the street!" he gasped, spitting blood. "We got to get out of here."
"Where's my corporal?"
"Already down the stairs. Let's go."
But no, it was time for a drink.
Pelion, not now! Garraway, if not now, when?
Spinner of death, knight of shadow, master of the deck.
Fiddler's voice was a cold, almost inhuman growl.
Table holds them, but not the rest.
And he started flinging cards, and each one he threw shot like a plate of iron to a lodestone, striking one person after another, hard against their chests, staggering them back a step, and with each impact, as Bryce stared in horror, the victim was lifted off the floor, chair tumbling away, and slammed against the wall behind them no matter the distance. The collisions cracked bones. Backs of heads crunched bloodily on the walls. It was all happening too fast, with Fiddler standing as if in the heart of a maelstrom, solid as a deep-rooted tree. The first struck was the girl Sin.
Virgin of death!
As the card smacked into her chest, it heaved her, limbs flailing, up to a section of wall just beneath the ceiling. The sound she made when she hit was sickening, and she went limp, hanging like a spiked rag doll.
Scepter!
Grubb shrieked, seeking to fling himself to one side, and the card deftly slid beneath him, fixing onto his chest and shoving him bodily across the floor, up against the wall just left of the door. Quick Ben's expression was one of stunned disbelief as Fiddler's third card slapped against his sternum.
Magus of Dark!
He was thrown into the wall behind him with enough force to send cracks through the plaster, and he hung there, motionless as a corpse on a spike.
Mason of Death!
Hedge bleated and made the mistake of turning round. The card struck his back and hammered him face first into the wall, whereupon the card began pushing him upward, leaving a red streak below the unconscious man. The others followed, quick as a handful of flung stones. In each, the effect was the same. Violent impact, walls that shook. Sandalath Drukorlat,
Queen of Dark.
Lostara Yil,
Champion of Life.
Obelisk,
Bottle. Gessler,
Orb.
Stormy,
Throne.
And then Fiddler faced Bryce.
King of Life.
The card flashed out from his hand, glittering like a dagger, and Bryce snatched a breath the instant before it struck, eyes closing. He felt the blow, but nowhere near as viciously as had the others, and nothing touched his breast. He opened his eyes to see the card hovering, shivering, in the air before him. Above it, he met Fiddler's flat eyes. The sapper nodded.
You're needed.
What? Two remained untouched, and Fiddler turned to the first and nearest of these.
Banaskar, he said. You keep poor company. Fool in chains.
He drew a card and snapped out his hand. The ex-priest grunted and was flung back over his chair, whereupon he shot upward to the domed ceiling. Dust engulfed the man at the impact. Fiddler now faced the adjunct.
You knew, didn't you?
Staring, pale as snow, she said nothing.
For you, Tavare Paran, nothing.
She flinched. The door suddenly opened, hinges squealing in the frozen silence. Turadal Brizard stepped into the chamber and then halted.
Turadal? No, of course not. The errant, who stands unseen behind the empty throne. I wondered when you would show yourself.
Bryce realized he had drawn his sword, realized too that the errant was here to kill him. A deed without reason, a desire without motive, at least none fathomable to anyone but the errant himself.
He will kill me, and then Fiddler for his audacity, and then everyone else here, so that there be no witnesses.
Fiddler slowly turned to study the errant. The Malazan's smile was chilling.
If that card was for you, he said, it would have left the table the moment you opened the door. I know you think it belongs to you. You think it's yours. You are wrong.
The errant's lone eye seemed to flare.
I am the master of the tiles.
And I don't care. Go on, then. Play with your tiles, Elder.
You cannot stand against the master of the deck. Your time, errant, is past.
I have returned.
As the errant, raw power building round him, took another stride into the chamber, Fiddler's low words cut into his pass.
I wouldn't do that.
The elder god sneered.
Do you think Bryce Bedict can stop me? Can stop what I intend here?
Fiddler's brows lifted.
I have no idea. But if you take one more step, errant, the master of the deck will come through. Here, now. Will you face him? Are you ready for that?
And Bryce glanced to that card lying on the table, inanimate, motionless. It seemed to yawn like the mouth of the abyss itself, and he suddenly shivered. Fiddler's quiet challenge had halted the errant, and Bryce saw uncertainty stirred to life on the once handsome features of Turidal Brizard.
For what it's worth, Bryce Bedict said then, you would not have made it past me anyway, errant.
A single eye flicked to him.
Ridiculous.
I have lived in stone, Elder One. I am written with names beyond counting. The man who died in the throne room is not the man who has returned, no matter what you see.
You tempt me to crush you,
the errant said in a half snarl. Fiddler swung round, stared down at the card on the table.
He is awakened.
He faced the elder god.
It may be too late for you.
And Bryce saw the errant suddenly step back, once, twice, the third time taking him through the doorway. A moment later, and he vanished from sight. Bodies were sliding slowly towards the floor. As far as Bryce could see, not one was conscious. Something eased in the chamber like the release of a breath held far too long.
Adjunct.
Tavare's attention snapped from the empty doorway back to the sapper.
Spring the ambush. Find your enemy.
This wasn't a reading, Fiddler said. No one here was found. No one was claimed. Adjunct, they were marked. You understand?
I do,
she whispered.
I think, Fiddler said, as grief clenched his face, I think I can see the end.
She nodded.
Tavare, said Fiddler, his voice now ragged. I am so sorry.
To that, the adjunct simply shook her head, and Bryce knew that, while he did not understand everything here, he understood enough. And if it could have meant anything, anything at all, he would have repeated Fiddler's words to her. To this adjunct, this Tavare Paran, this wretchedly lonely woman. At that moment, the limp form of Banaskar settled onto the tabletop, like a corpse being lowered on a noose. As he came to rest, he groaned. Fiddler walked over and collected the card called the Master of the Deck. He studied it for a moment, and then returned it to the deck in his hands. Glancing over at Bryce, he winked.
Nicely played, Sergeant. Felt so lifeless, still does. I'm kind of worried.
Bryce nodded. Even so, the role did not feel vacant.
That's true, thanks.
You know this master?
Aye.
Sergeant, had the errant called your bluff?
Fiddler grinned.
You would have been on your own, sir.
Still, you sounded confident enough.
Malazans aren't the only ones capable of bluffing. And as they shared a true smile, the adjunct simply stared on, from one man to the other, and said nothing.
Bug stood at the back window, looking out on Seren Pedak's modest garden that was now softly brushed with the silvery tones reflected down from the dusty, smoky clouds hanging over the city. There had been damage done this night, far beyond one or two knocked-down buildings. The room had been silent behind him for some time now, from the moment that the reading had ended a short while ago. He still felt fragile, almost fractured. He heard her stir into motion behind him, a soft grunt as she climbed upright, and then she was beside him.
Are they dead, Buck?
He turned and glanced at the now conjoined, colourless puddles on the floor beneath the two chairs.
I don't know, he admitted, and then added, I think so.
That was not expected. Please tell me, Cedar, that such a fate was not in the plans tonight.
No, Aquitor.
Then what happened?
He rubbed at the bristles on his chin, and then sighed and shook his head.
She chooses a narrow path. God's the audacity of it! I must speak with the king, and with Bryce. We need to decide.
Cedar, who killed Pinnacel and Ersto?
He faced her, blinked.
Death but passed through. Even the errant was dismissed.
He snorted.
Yes, dismissed. There is so much power in this deck of dragons. In the right hands, it could drain us all dry. Every god, new and elder, every ascendant cast into a role, every mortal doomed to become a face on a card.
He resumed his gaze out the window.
He dropped one onto the table. Your sons. The table would hold it, he said. Thus he made no effort to claim your son. He let it be. He let him be.
And then he shivered.
Pinnacel and Ersto, they just sat too close to the fire.
They what?
The caster held back Aquitor. No one attacked Ersto and Pinnacel. Even your unborn son's card did not try for him. The caster locked it down, as would a carpenter driving a nail through a plank of wood. Abyss take me, the sheer brazen power to do that leaves me breathless. Aquitor, Ersto and Pinnacel were here to defend you from the errant. And yes, we felt him. We felt his murderer's desire. But then he was thrown back, his power scattered. What arrived in its place was like the face of the sun, ever growing, becoming so vast as to fill the world. They were pinned there, trapped in those chairs, unable to move.
He shook himself.
We all were.
He looked down at the puddles.
Aquitor, I truly do not know if they are dead. The Lord of Death fed on no one this night, beyond a few hapless souls in a destroyed inn. They may be simply reduced, and after a time they will reconstitute themselves, find their shapes, their flesh and bone, once more. I do not know, yet I will hope.
He saw her studying his face, and wondered if he'd managed to hide any of his anxiety, his grief. The look in her eyes spoke of his failure.
Speak with this caster, she said, and ask him to refrain. Never again in this city, please.
He was unwilling, Aquitor. He did what he could to protect everyone. Except, I think, himself. I do not think there will be another reading.
She stared out the window.
What awaits him, my son?
She asked in a whisper.
He understood her question.
He will have you, Seren Pedak. Mothers possess a strength vast and strange.
Strange?
Bug smiled.
Strange to us. Unfathomable. Also, your son's father was much loved. There will be those among his friends who would not hesitate.
Onrak Temlava,
she said. Bug nodded.
An Imas.
Whatever that is.
Aquitor, the Imas are many things. And among those things, one virtue stands above all the others. Their loyalty cannot be sundered. They feel such forces with a depth vast and...
strange?
Bug said nothing for a moment, knowing that he could, if he so chose, be offended by the implication in that lone word she had added to his sentence. Instead, he smiled.
Even so.
I am sorry, Cedar. You are right. Onrak was remarkable and a great comfort to me. Still, I do not expect him to visit again.
He will when your son is born.
How will he know when that happens?
Because his bonecaster wife, Kilava, set a blessing upon you and your child. By this means, she remains aware of you and your condition.
Oh, would she have sensed tonight, then? The risk? The danger?
perhaps, Bug replied. She would have been attentive. And had some form of breach occurred to directly threaten you, then I suspect that, yes, she would have intervened.
How could she have hoped to defend me? Seren said, if three ancient gods had already failed.
Bug sighed. A conviction I am slowly coming to accept. People do not understand power. They view it exclusively as a contest, this against that. Which is the greater? Which wins? Which fails? Power is less about actual conflict, recognizing as it does the mutual damage conflict entails, with such damage making one vulnerable, less about actual conflict than it is about statements. Presence, Aquitor, is power's truest expression, and presence is, at its core, the occupation of space, an assertion, if you will, one that must be acknowledged by other powers, lesser or greater, it matters not.
I am not sure I understand you.
Kelava would have invoked her presence, Aquitor, one that embraced you. Now, if you still insist on simplistic comparisons, then I tell you, she would have been as a stone in a stream. The water may dream of victory, may even yearn for it, but it had best learn patience, yes? Consider every dried stream bed you have seen, Aquitor, and judge who was the ultimate victor in that war of patience. The woman sighed, and Bug heard her exhaustion. He bowed to her. I shall leave. Matters remain pressing for me, but the danger to you and your unborn son has passed.
She glanced back at the puddles. Do I just mop that up?
Leave it for the morning. It may be that you will find little more than a stain by then.
I can point to it when I have guests and say, this is where two gods melted.
Yes, she had need to defend herself against the events of this night. No room in her thoughts for the moment for anything but the child within her. Despite her words, she was not indifferent to the sundering of Pinnacel and Erstow. Everything right now was about control, and this, Bug understood, came from that ineffable strength within a woman who was or would be her mother.
They are stubborn, those two. I would not discount them quite yet.
I hope you are right. Thank you, Cedar. Even if the threat did not come to pass, I do appreciate your willingness to protect us. Please do not be offended if I add that I hope I never experience another night like this.
I take no offense. Good night, Aquitor.
Beyond the moment's heat, in the cool trickle that was the aftermath of a confrontation, bleak realizations shook free in the mind of the errant. While he did not know if indeed the master of the deck had awakened, as the Malazan had claimed, the risk of such a premature clash had been too great. As for Bryce Bedict and his bold arrogance, that was a different matter. The errant stood in an alley, not far from the Malazan headquarters, and he trembled with rage and something else, something that tasted delicious, the promise of vengeance. No, Bryce Bedict would not survive his return journey to the palace. It did not matter the fool's skills with a sword. Against the raw assault of the errant sorcery, no flickering blade could defend. True, this would be no gentle, unseen nudge, but old habits, by their very predictability, could be exploited, defended against. Besides, at times, the subtle did not satisfy. He recalled, with a rush of pleasure, holding Featherwitch's head under the water until her feeble struggles ceased. Yes, there was glory in being so forceful, so direct in the implementation of one's own will. It could become addictive, and indeed he welcomed the invitation. So much gnawed at him at the moment, however, that he was anxious and wary about doing much of anything. The caster had been frightening. The ones who were made miserable by the use of their own power ever disturbed the errant, for he could not fathom such creatures, did not understand their reluctance, the self-imposed rules governing their behavior. Motives were essential. One could not understand one's enemy without a sense of what they wanted, what they hungered for. But that caster, all he had hungered for was to be left alone. Perhaps that in itself could be exploited, except that clearly, when the caster was pushed, he did not hesitate to push back, unblinking, smiling, appallingly confident.
Leave him for now. Think of the others. Any threats to me?
The Aquitor's child had guardians assembled to defend it. Those squalid drunks. Male. Other presences as well. Something ancient, black-furred with glowing eyes. He'd heard its warning growl like a rumble of thunder, and that had been enough to discourage the errant's approach. Well, the child could wait. Oh, this was a vicious war indeed. But he had potential allies. Banaskar, a weak man, one he could use again, and Fenner, the cowering god of war. Yes, he could feed on the fool's power. He could take what he wanted, all in exchange for the sanctuary he offered. Finally, there were other forces far to the east who might well value his alliance. Much still to do. But for now, this night, he would have his vengeance against that miserable heap of armor Bryce bedicked. And so he waited for the fool to depart the headquarters. No nudge this time. No, only his hands on the bastard's throat would appease the depth of the errant's malice. True enough, the man who had died was not the same man who returned. More to Bryce Bedict than just an interminable skein of names written into the stone of his soul. There was something else, as if the man cast more than one shadow. If Bryce was destined for something else, for something more than he was now, then it behoved the errant to quell the threat immediately. Remove him from the game, and this time make certain he stayed dead. Nothing could be worse than to walk into a room in a middling inn, stride up to the bed and fling back the woolen blanket only to find a dragon, or two, all unwillingly unveiled, and in a single miserable instant the illusions of essential mutual protection are cast off, violent transformation, and lo, it turns out, one small room in an inn cannot hold two dragons. It is the conviction of serving staff the world over that they have seen everything. The hapless maid working at the inn in question could now make claim to such an achievement. Alas, it was a short-lived triumph. Tellerast and Curdle, assembled once more into their quaint, tiny skeletal forms, which had become so much a part of them, so preciously adorable that neither could bear to part with the lovely lizards, were now on a hilltop a few leagues north of the city. Once past the indignity of the unexpected event and their panicked flight from Letharas, they had spent the last bell or so howling in laughter. The expression on the maid's face was truly unforgettable, and when Curdle's draconic head had smashed through the wall to fill the corridor, why, every resident guest had then popped out from their rooms for a look at the source of the terrible ruckus. My, such consternation! Curdle squealed in gut-busting hilarity, or would have. Had she a gut? Tellerast's tiny fangs still glistened with blood, although when she'd last used them, they had been much, much larger. An instinctive snap, no one could blame her, not really, had collected up a fat merchant in the street below, a moment before she herself landed to fill it amidst crashing bricks and quarried limestone. And was it not essential among carnivores to indulge in blubber on occasion? It must be so, for some scholar had said it, once, somewhere. In any case, he had been delicious. Could one blame the shark that takes a swimmer's leg, the coiling serpent that devours a toddler, the wolves that run down an old woman? Of course not. One might decry the deed and weep for the slain victims, but to then track and hunt the killer down, as if it was some kind of evil murderer, was simply ridiculous. Indeed, it was hubris of the worst sort.
It's the way of the world that there are hunters and the hunted, Curdle, and to live in the world is to accept that as a truth. Beasts eat other beasts, and the same is true for all these precious humans. Do they not thrive and preen as hunters? Of course they do, but sometimes the hunter becomes the hunted, yes? Consider, if you will, and you will, some bow-legged yokel traps a hare for supper. Should the rest of the hares all gather and incite themselves into deadly vengeance against that yokel? Would this be proper and just? I dare say the hares would think so, cried Curdle, spiny tail lashing the short grasses. No doubt, no doubt. But think of the outrage among the yokel's family and friends. Why, there'd be a war, a feud. Soldiers would be called in. Slit-eyed scouts and master hunters wearing green floppy hats. The king would raise taxes and 1,000 whores would follow in the baggage train. Poets would sing rousing ballads to fan the flames of righteousness. Entire epics would be penned to recount the venal escapades. They're just puffed up on themselves, Telerast, that's all. They're all emperors and empresses in their own puny minds, don't you see? With all in the domain theirs to do with as they will, how dare some dumb beast bite back? We'll get them in the end, Curdle. Us and the hares. Exactly. Rule the domain, will you? No, my friends, the domain rules you.
Telerast fell silent then, as grim thoughts whispered through her.
Curdle, she ventured, lifting her small reptilian skull. We'll need to act soon. I know, it's awful. Someone in the city's causing trouble. We don't like trouble, do we? At least I don't think we do. Unless it's ours, Telerast. If we're the ones causing trouble, that's just fine. Perfect, in fact. Until it all goes wrong, like last time. And wasn't that your fault? That's how I remember it, Curdle. All your fault. This time round, watch yourself. Do as I say, everything I say. Should we tear him apart, then? Who? The one who likes keeping the throne empty. In, out, in, out, in, out. Just shuffle them through. Nobody gets comfortable. Chaos and confusion, civil wars and betrayals and blood everywhere. What a creep. You think we should tear him apart, Curdle? I thought I was supposed to be following your lead. So lead, Telerast. Do we rend him into little messy pieces, or don't we? That depends.
Telerast leapt to her taloned feet and began pacing, tiny forearms twitching.
Is he the enemy? Is he what? Sweetness, aren't they all our enemies? Ach, you're right. What got into me? Simple. He just thought to ignore us. We don't like being ignored. People who ignore us die. That's the rule we've always lived by. Snub us, and we'll chew you into mangled flaps of skin and hair, chips of bone, things that drip and leak. Should we go and kill him, then? Maybe. Oh, tell me what to do. I can't tell you to follow my lead unless I get guidance from you first. It's a partnership, all right, agreed Curdle. Let me think.
Telerast paused, head lifting yet higher.
Gah! What's those green blobs in the sky?
Don't come near me.
Withal eyed his wife, decided he'd seen this before, and so kept his distance.
Why did she want you there at all? That's what I can't figure.
Sandalath sat down, the effort a protracted procedure measured in winces, grunts, and cautious sighs.
I didn't anticipate a physical assault, that's for sure.
Withal almost stepped forward then, but managed to restrain his instinctive gesture.
She beat you up? Gods below, I knew the adjunct was a hard woman, but that's going too far. Oh, be quiet. Of course she didn't beat me up. Let's just say the cards were assigned with some, force. As if that would convince us of anything. The whole sorcery surrounding the deck of dragons is an affront to sensible creatures like me.
Sensible? Well, I suppose. The caster found you a card, then. Which one?
He watched as she weighed the value of answering him.
It threw me into a wall.
What did?
The card, you idiot! Queen of Dark! As if I could be anything like that. Stupid deck, what does it know of High House Dark? The past is dead, the throne's abandoned. There is no king and certainly no queen. It's senseless. How can Quick Ben be makers of Dark? He's not even Tist Andy. Bah, all nonsense, all of it. Gods, I think my ribs are cracked. Make some tea, love. Be useful.
Glad I waited up for you,
Withal muttered, setting off to brew a pot.
Any preferences?
No, but add a drop of Dabayang oil, will you? Next time I'll wear armor. Is it cold in here? Feed the hearth. I don't want to get a chill. Throw me those furs. Is that water pipe just ornamental? Do we have any Durhang? Gods, it hurts to talk.
News to me, darling.
The dead iguana's last animate act had been to clamp its jaws on Limp's right ear. The soldier was weeping softly as Dead Smell knelt beside him and tried to prise loose the lizard's savage grip. Blood flowed, and it looked as if Limp was going to be left with half an ear on that side. Ebron was sitting on the bed, head in his hands.
"It'll be all right, Limp. We'll get the knee fixed up. Maybe sew that bit of ear back on."
"No, we won't," said Dead Smell. "That'll go septic for sure and then spread out. Iguana saliva, especially a dead iguana's saliva, is bound to be nasty stuff. As it is, I'll need to work a ritual to purge whatever toxins have already slipped into him." He paused. "Massan, you can crawl out from under the bed now."
"So you say," the woman replied, then coughed. "What damned hairballs! I'll never be clean again."
Limp squealed when Dead Smell worked a knife blade between the iguana's jaws, and failing to open them, simply started cutting at the tendons and muscle tissue at the hinges. A moment later, and the creature fell away, startling everyone when it whistled an exhalation through its slitted nostrils.
"I thought you said it was dead," Cord accused, walking over to slam his boot heel down on the iguana's head. Things splattered out to the sides.
"Now it is," Dead Smell affirmed. "Lie still, Limp. Let's get the healing started."
"You should never let necromancers heal people," Crump complained, glowering from the corner of the room.
The various components of his woodcarving, shapeless riders on shapeless horses, had all vanished out into the corridor after breaching the door, which seemed to have been achieved by a combination of chewing and hacking and who knew what else. Dead Smell scowled over at the sapper.
"You wouldn't be saying that if you were dying of some wound and I was your only hope."
"Yes, I would."
The necromancer offered him a nasty smile.
"We'll see someday, won't we?"
"No, we won't. I'll kill you first before I get wounded."
"And then we'd both be dead."
"That's right. So there. Just what I was saying. Nothing good comes of no necromancer's know-how."
The flickerbird was a mashed heap of feathers on the floor. The bat turtle had fled through the hole in the door, possibly in pursuit of the wooden troop. The black-furred rat still clung on all fours to the ceiling. Shard moved to stand opposite Ebron.
"Was Dead Smell right, mate? Did the Lord of Death show up here?"
"No, not as such. Why don't you ask him yourself?"
"Because he's busy healing. I want to hear from you, Ebron."
"More like all the Warrens woke up all at once. Corporal, I don't know what the adjunct's playing at, but it won't be fun. We're going to march soon. I think tonight's decided it. The roles are set, only I doubt anybody, even Taveray, knows all the players. Noses are going to get bloodied."
Dead Smell had, of course, been listening. Working on the wreck that was Limp's knee had become rote for the healer, as it was for virtually every healer in the company, not one of whom had escaped delivering ministrations to the hapless fool.
"Ebron's right. I don't envy your squad. If you end up as Sin's escort again, she's right in the middle of it."
"I don't like her neither," said Crump.
Ebron sneered at Dead Smell.
"How close we happen to be with anybody won't make any difference. We're all in trouble."
An odd, frothy, bubbling sound drew everyone's attention, and all eyes fixed on the crushed head of the iguana as it exhaled yet again. A snort came from under the bed.
"I ain't leaving here until the sun comes up."
The others had left, their departure more a headlong flight than a solemn dismissal, until only the adjunct, Lostara Yill and Bryce Bedict remained. Plaster dust hazed the light from the lanterns, and the floor ground and crunched underfoot. Bryce watched as the adjunct slowly sat down in the chair at the head of the table, and it was hard to determine which woman was more shaken or distraught. Whatever sorrow was buried within Lostara Yill now seemed much closer to the surface, and she had said not a word since Fiddler's exit, standing with arms crossed, a gesture that likely had as much to do with aching ribs as anything else.
"Thank you," said the adjunct, "for being here, sir."
Startled, Bryce frowned.
"I may well have been the reason for the errant's attention, adjunct. You would perhaps be more justified in cursing me instead."
"I do not believe that," she replied. "We are in the habit of acquiring enemies.
This is the errant's backyard, Bryce pointed out. Naturally, he resents intruders. But even more, he despises the other residents who happen to share it with him. People like me, adjunct. She glanced up at him. You were dead once, or so I understand. Resurrected. He nodded. It is extraordinary how little choice one has in such matters. If I mull on that over long, I become despondent. I do not appreciate the notion of being so easily manipulated. I would prefer to think of my soul as my own. She looked away and then settled her hands flat on the table before her, a strange gesture, whereupon she seemed to study them. Fiddler spoke of the errant's rival, the master of the deck of dragons. She hesitated and then added, That man is my brother, Genos Paran. Ah, I see. She shook her head, but would not look up, intent on her hands. I doubt that. We may share blood, but insofar as I know, we are not allies. Not close. There are old issues between us, matters that cannot be salved, not by deed, not by word. Sometimes, Bryce ventured, when nothing can be shared except regret, then regret must serve as the place to begin. Reconciliation does not demand that one side surrender to the other. The simple mutual recognition that mistakes were made is in itself a closing of the divide. She managed a half-smile. Bryce Bedict, your words, however wise, presume communication between the parties involved. Alas, this has not been the case. Perhaps, then, you might have welcomed the master's attention this night. Yet, if I did indeed understand, Fiddler, no such contact was in truth forthcoming. Your soldier bluffed. Tell me, if you would, is your brother aware of your predicament? She shot him a look, sharp, searching. I do not recall sharing any details of my predicament. Bryce was silent, wondering what secret web he had just set trembling. She rose, frowned over at Lostara for a moment, as if surprised to find her still there, and then said, Inform the king that we intend to depart soon. We will be rendezvousing with allies at the border to the wastelands, whereupon we shall march east. She paused. Naturally, we must ensure that we are well supplied with all necessities. Of course, we shall pay in silver and gold for said materiel. We would seek to dissuade you, adjunct, said Bryce. The wastelands are aptly named, and as for the lands east of them, what little we hear has not been promising. We're not looking for promises, the adjunct replied. Bryce Bedict bowed. I shall take my leave now, adjunct. Do you wish an escort? He shook his head. That will not be necessary. Thank you for the offer. The roof would have to do. He'd wanted a tower, something ridiculously high, or a pinnacle on some tottering, ragged keep moments from plunging off the cliff into the thrashing seas below. Or perhaps a cliffside fastness on some raw mountain, slick with ice and drifts of snow. An abbey atop a mesa, with the only access through a rope and pulley system with a wicker basket to ride in. But this roof would have to do. Quick Ben glared at the greenish smear in the south sky. That troop of celestial riders, not one of whom had any good news to deliver, no doubt.
Magus of Dark, the bastard. You got a nasty nose, Fid, haven't you just? And don't even try it with that innocent look. One more disarming shrug from you, and I'll ram 10 warrens down your throat. Magus of Dark. There was a throne once. No, never mind. Just stay away from Sandalath, that's all. Stay away, ducked out of sight. It was just a reading, after all. Fiddler's usual mumbo-jumbo. Means nothing, meant nothing. Don't bother me, I'm busy. Magus of Dark.
Fiddler was now drunk, along with Stormy and Gessler, badly singing old Napan pirate songs, not one of which was remotely clever. Bottle, sporting 3 fractured ribs, had shuffled off to find a healer he could bribe awake. Sin and Grub had run away like a couple of rats whose tails had just been chopped off by the world's biggest cleaver. And Hedge was creeping up behind him right now, worse than an addled assassin.
Go away. Not a chance, quick. We got to talk. No, we don't. He said I was the Mason of Death. So build a crypt and climb inside, Hedge. I'll be happy to seal it for you with every ward I can think of. The thing is, Fid's probably right.
Eyes narrowing, Quick Ben faced the sapper.
Hood's been busy of late. You'd know more of that than me, and don't deny it. It's got nothing to do with us.
You sure?
Quick Ben nodded.
Then why am I the Mason of Death?
A shout echoed from the nearby rooftops and Quick Ben flinched.
Because you're needed,
he said after a moment.
To do what? You're needed,
Quick Ben snarled.
To build us a road.
Hedge stared.
Gods below, where are we going? The real question is whether we'll ever get there. Listen, Hedge, she's nothing like you think. She's nothing like any of us thinks. I can't explain. I can't get any closer than that. Don't try anticipating or second-guessing. She'll confound you at every turn. Just look at this reading. That was Fid's doing. You think so? You're dead wrong. He knows because she told him. Him and no one else. Now you can try to twist Fiddler for details all you like. It won't work. The truth as much as cut out his tongue.
So what's made you Magus of Dark? What miserable piss-sour secret you holding back on now, Quick?
The wizard turned away once more, stared out over the city, and then stiffened.
Shit, what now?
The sorcery erupted from an alley mouth, striking Bryce Bedict from his left side. The impact sent him sprawling, grey tendrils writhing like serpents about his body. In the span of a single heartbeat, the magic had bound him tight, arms trapped. The coils began constricting. Lying on his back, staring up at the night sky, that had at last begun to pale, Bryce heard footsteps, and a moment later the errant stepped into the range of his vision. The god's single eye gleamed like a star burning through mist.
I warned you, Bryce Bedict. This time there will be no mistakes. Yes, it was me who nudged you to take that mouthful of poisoned wine. Oh, the Chancellor had not anticipated such a thing, but he can be forgiven that. After all, how could I have imagined that you'd found a guardian among Mael's minions?
He paused and then said,
No matter, I am done with subtlety. This is much better. I can look into your eyes and watch you die. And what could be more satisfying than that?
The sorcery tautened, forcing Bryce's breath from his lungs. Darkness closed in round his vision until all he could see was the errant's face, a visage that had lost all grace as avid hunger twisted the features. He watched as the god lifted one hand and slowly clenched the fingers, and the pressure around Bryce's chest built until his ribs creaked. The new fist that arrived hammered like a maul against the side of the errant's head, snapping it far over. The gleaming eyes seemed to wink out, and the god crumpled, vanishing from Bryce's dwindling vision. All at once, the coils weakened and then frayed into dissolving threads. Bryce drew a ragged, delicious breath of chill night air. He heard horse hoofs, a half dozen beasts, maybe more, approaching at a canter from up the street. Blinking sweat from his eyes, Bryce rolled onto his stomach and then forced himself to his knees. A hand closed on his harness and lifted him to his feet. He found himself staring up at a Tarthanol, a familiar face, the heavy, robust features knotted absurdly into a fierce frown.
I got a question for you. It was for your brother and I was on my way, but then I saw you.
The riders arrived, horses skidding on the dew-slick cobbles. A Malazan troop, Bryce saw, weapons unsheathed. One of them, a dark-skinned woman, pointed with a sword.
He crawled into that alley. Come on, let's chop the bastard into stewing meat.
She made to dismount and then seemed to sag, and an instant later she collapsed onto the street, weapon clattering. Other soldiers dropped down from their mounts. Three of them converged on the unconscious woman, while the others fanned out and advanced into the alley. Bryce was still having difficulty staying upright. He found himself leaning with one forearm against the Tarthanal.
Ublala Pung, he sighed. Thank you.
I got a question.
Bryce nodded.
All right, let's hear it.
But that's the problem. I forgot what it was.
One of the Malazans crowded round the woman, now straightened, and faced them.
Sinta said there was trouble, he said in heavily accented trader tongue. Said we needed to hurry, to here, to save someone.
I believe, Bryce said, the danger has passed. Is she all right, sir?
I'm a sergeant. People don't sir me, sir. She's just done in, both her and her sister.
He scowled.
But we'll escort you just the same, sir. She'd never forgive us if something happened to you now. So, wherever you're going.
The other soldiers emerged from the alley, and one said something in Malazan, although Bryce needed no translation to understand that they'd found no one. The errant's survival instincts were ever strong, even when he'd been knocked silly by a Tarthanol's fist.
It seems, Bryce said, I shall have an escort after all.
It is not an offer you can refuse, sir, said the sergeant.
Nor will I. Lesson learned, adjunct. The soldiers were attempting to heave the woman named Sinta back into her saddle. Ublala Pung stepped up to them.
I will carry her, he said. She's pretty. Do as the Toblakai says, said the sergeant. She's pretty,
Ublala Pung said again, as he took her limp form in his arms.
Pretty smelly, too, but that's okay. Perimeter escort, snapped the sergeant. Crossbows cocked. Anybody steps out, nail 'em.
Bryce prayed there would be no early risers between here and the palace.
Best we hurry, he ventured.
On a rooftop not far away, Quick Ben sighed and then relaxed.
What was all that about?
Hedge asked beside him.
Damned Toblakai. But that's not the interesting bit, though, is it? No, it's that Dalhanese woman. Well, that can all wait. You're babbling, wizard. Magus of Dark. Gods below.
Alone in the cellar beneath the dormitories, Fiddler stared down at the card in his hand. The lacquered wood glistened, dripped as if slick with sweat. The smell rising from it was of humus, rich and dark, a scent of the raw earth.
Tarthano Toblakai, he whispered. Herald of life. Well, just so.
He set it down and then squinted at the second card he had withdrawn to close this dread night.
Unaligned.
Chain.
Aye, we all know about those, my dear. Fret not, it's the price of living. Now if only you weren't so strong. If only you were weaker. If only your chains didn't reach right into the heart of the bone hunters. If only I knew who was dragging who, why, I might have reason to hope. But he didn't, and so there wasn't.